Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. People who visited Philadelphia journalist Brian Hickey in the hospital after a near-fatal accident say they thought he was done. They didn't believe he could ever recover, and if he did, they thought he would never again be the same Brian they knew. Hickey had been walking to a New Jersey train station in November of 2008 when he was struck by a car. The driver then fled the scene. About 11% of vehicle accidents are hit-and-run, and the drivers often leave hurt or dead victims behind. We will discuss hit-and-run accidents today on Radio Times and hear Brian's story of injury and recovery and talk about his quest to shed light on these accidents. Brian is joining us in the studio. He's been a journalist in Philadelphia for many years and recently joined WHYY as the editor for the Germantown West Oak Lane hyperlocal section of our website, newsworks.org. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us in the studio is Jim Lardier. He is the Director for Public and Government Affairs for AAA Mid-Atlantic. Jim, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome, Mike, and thanks.
And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. So, Brian, let's start with you. On the evening of November 28th, 2008, you had been hanging out with old friends and then left a bar around 10, and then what?
Well, then I don't know. I have the next month, I guess. But from what I was able to gather, I was walking to the Speedline station in Collingswood, and I got about halfway there, which, all told, it's about 3/4 of a mile of a walk from door to door. And neighbors reported hearing screeching and then a thud and then a car, just seeing the taillights of a car. They found me because of a dog barking in a window, a fellow by the name of Mike Freeman. He was in his house watching Rudy on the night after Thanksgiving. His dog wouldn't stop barking, so he came outside, saw me laying in the street, and called paramedics. I was conscious at that point. From the looks of the scene, it seems as if the car was maybe driving about 40 miles an hour, tried to hit its brakes. I went up on the hood and got thrown. They had to fast forward to Cooper Trauma, which is about 10 minutes away. A lucky break, just being so close to a trauma center. I guess passed out would be the term for it. About 3 hours later, the next night, they cut 2 pieces of my skull out. I had 3, I think, fractured vertebrae. I could be wrong about that. If my wife's listening and she could call and then correct me, that'd be great. And then I was in a coma for 9 days. 9 or 10. It's kind of fluid in that you don't know when you're comatose or when you're coming out of a coma. But I spent 21 days at Cooper. They transferred me to McGee Rehab in Center City, where I essentially came to, for lack of a better term, after a few days. And then I spent about a month learning to walk and talk and count and write again.
The real work.
Yeah.
Was at McGee, and I want to talk to you more about that. But Jim Lardier of AAA, how many hit and runs happen every year? I don't know if you have nationwide numbers or region-wide numbers.
Sure. Well, the Pennsylvania State Police investigated 7,345 hit and run accidents in 2009, 454 of which were resulted in death or bodily injury. You made a great point. About 11% of all police-reported crashes involve a hit-and-run driver, with the majority being pedestrians.
And what do we know about why do people leave the scene?
It could be a variety of reasons, but over 2000 to 2005, we've seen a 20% increase in the number of hit-and-run accidents. And a lot of it falls into some of the same categories, such as unlicensed drivers, they're uninsured, unregistered, under the influence, also unawareness. Maybe they didn't realize that they hit a human being, thought they hit something inside the road, look, don't see anything. Unsympathetic, just a basic lack of compassion. And then another piece is the distracted driving, unfortunately, being unfocused behind the wheel and not really aware of what's going on around you.
And are they typically caught? Brian, since your accident, you've spent a lot of time investigating these accidents. So what are you finding? Are drivers typically caught?
It's hard to put a number on it. I keep a list on my website of just the instances of hit and runs happening involving pedestrians across the country. I'd ballpark it at about half that there's a follow-up story in the media of somebody being caught. And that doesn't mean I'm seeing every instance of either a hit and run or an arrest involved in it, but it's a wide spectrum of people when they do get caught. I mean, everything under the sun. It's young, it's old, it's male, it's female, it's they thought they hit a deer, it's they were hammered. And the same goes for victims. You have two-year-olds, you have 88-year-olds getting hit and left at the scene. So it's, I don't think there is any kind of central casting for a driver or a victim.
We're talking about hit-and-run accidents, why people leave the scene, what might work in preventing these accidents. We're also hearing the personal story of Brian Hickey, longtime Philadelphia journalist who lived through a grueling accident where he was left basically for dead on the side, not the sidewalk, there was no sidewalk, Brian, right, on the street. And we're also joined here in the studio by Jim Lardier, who is the Director for Public and Government Affairs for AAA Mid-Atlantic. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. And Brian, I want to go back to that night in November. Now, you had been taken first to the Cooper Trauma Center.
Yes.
In the meantime, did your family know where you were?
No. That was probably the most difficult, among the most difficult things for my wife. She didn't know where I was until, I think, about 8 a.m. when she got a call from police.
The next day.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just, either I took off for Atlantic City and was gambling in a casino without cell phone reception, or I was dead. I mean, she just didn't know, and it was, while I wasn't there to see what it was like, it was grueling for her, and the whole first month was, really. But it's surprising to me that they found me with my wallet on me, so I think there was a way that she could have found out sooner. But then again, they were trying to save my life at the hospital, so I guess notifying next of kin when I wasn't even a fatality at that point was probably secondary on their list of concerns.
And then what did the police do to investigate the crimes? And you went back, you being a journalist and a reporter, obviously,
right,
you went and checked all this out. But what happened, what was being done to find the person who did this?
I don't know, because I really wasn't conscious for the first month. But, I mean, the police, they investigated it. They talked to the neighbors. They went to body shops. My family and friends who, and even people who I didn't even know, just launched this massive effort that I'll never be able to thank them for, especially the total strangers and the family who was not knowing whether I was going to live or die. But, I mean, they put everything down and just papered the neighborhood and went to the body shops and, I mean, just asked everybody in the neighborhood what they saw. And, unfortunately, nobody saw anything but the rear lights of the car maybe 30 yards away.
And Jim Lardier, what, I know this varies from state to state,
sure,
in terms of what happens to people who do hit and runs, but give us some examples. What are the punishments like? What happens if you turn yourself in as compared to being caught?
Well, one of the interesting things before I jump into kind of state law is that with drunk drivers, sometimes what we're seeing is that they feel that if they can escape, the penalty is higher for being a drunk driver in an alcohol-related crash than it would be for being a hit and run. So they're willing to take their chances to avoid what they would assume would be that harsher penalty for a DUI involved accident. And in Pennsylvania last year, there was an effort to kind of strengthen some of the state laws, but those bills never really moved anywhere. If you give me a second, I can kind of slide through.
Yeah, Brian, you've also, have you done any legislative work in the wake of your accident?
I've spoken with a state senator, Larry Farnese, actually, who has been trying to push to get them increased, and there seem to be walls to doing that. Last year, it was a matter of some legislators not wanting, in an election year, not wanting mandatory minimums and complaining about prisons being overcrowded. This year, I just spoke with someone last week, and it was, well, we don't have enough time left in this session, so maybe we'll get to it next year, which in a lot of ways is patently offensive that they're almost saying, well, yeah, it's a problem, but it's not worth our time or effort. And if anything, infuriates me almost as much as people getting hit by cars. It's a callousness and an unwillingness to kind of punish those who are caught. And it's like we were talking about the other day, it's a matter of my personally wanting vengeance.
Because I'm wondering, Brian, do you think these laws would work in prevention, or do you think it would only work in terms of doing justice to those who were hit? Because I'm thinking people are not thinking straight in that moment, obviously.
Yeah, I can understand why people take off. But I think if they were on par, if you didn't have the option of going and getting the booze out of your system and getting less of a penalty, like if it was on par, that either you if you stay, you get the same penalty as if you go and you sober up. I think that may have an impact, but I think what we're talking about is the morality of a person, less so than the panic where some people call in 15 minutes later, and I have less of a problem with that than, say, someone who just takes off and leaves someone dead in the street.
Well, I would agree with Brian's point there. I mean, I think what we're seeing is people putting their own personal self-preservation really over accepting personal responsibility. They turn a tragic accident into a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And you had asked about some of the penalties for the surrounding states. In Pennsylvania, if a victim suffers, you know, serious bodily injury, it's classified as a felony of the third degree if they are convicted of it. And then the minimum fine is $1,000 with minimum imprisonment of not less than 90 days. And then if that person dies, if it's a felony, if the victim is killed in the accident, it's also a felony of the third degree with a minimum fine of $2,500 and imprisonment of not less than 1 year. And Brian had been at work on some of the bills that would have looked to strengthen these penalties.
And Brian, we only have about a minute left till we go to break, but now imagine if your driver was caught, $1,000 in 90 days, that seems weak.
Yeah, in some respects, sure, but if I was able to pick a penalty, I would, the number of days I was laid up, that's fine for me. Like, you either get house arrest or go to jail for 3-4 months. It's the cases where people aren't as lucky as I was, and where is 2 years enough, is 5 years enough? No, I don't think it is. And it's a shame that we're not in a position in Pennsylvania specifically to even, unless they pile on an ag assault charge, to even get adequate punishment.
We're going to talk more. We have a break coming up. We're talking about hit-and-run accidents, why drivers flee the scene, what can be done to stop that, what should be fair punishment for those who run. Joining us in the studio is Brian Hickey, Philadelphia journalist. He is with WHYY now as the editor for the Germantown West Oak Lane section of our website, newsworks.org. Also joined by Jim Lardier, who is director for public and government affairs for AAA Mid-Atlantic. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY, presenting Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique on November 15th in Verizon Hall. Conductor John Elliott Gardner leads his renowned period instrument ensemble through an all-Beethoven program that includes the Eroica and the Fifth Symphony. Playing authentic 18th-century instruments, Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique offers a rare glimpse into how these Beethoven works might have sounded when they first premiered. Tickets 215-893-1999 or kimmelcenter.org.
Every step you take in this race is a step toward a brighter future. A statement of support for a place where curious minds of all ages can discover, unlock mysteries, experience arts and culture. The Y12K Road Race, supporting WHYY. Challenge yourself physically and help us continue to provide educational, trustworthy, one-of-a-kind shows and services. Saturday, November 12th. Sign up and learn more at whyy.org/Y12K.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University offers over 150 undergraduate and graduate programs, including a computer science degree certified by the National Security Agency, nationally accredited business programs, and research opportunities like the Liquid Life Laboratory. More details are available online at wcupa.edu. That's online at wcupa.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowane, and we're talking about hit-and-run accidents with Philadelphia journalist Brian Hickey, who survived such a hit-and-run accident where he was hit as a pedestrian. He is the editor for the Germantown West Oak Lane hyperlocal section of our website, newsworks.org. And also joining us in the studio is Jim Lardier, who's director for public and government affairs for AAA Mid-Atlantic. So, Brian, before our break, you were describing when you got hit, which was in November of 2008, the driver left the scene. You were then first at Cupra Trauma. And describe, I mean, obviously you don't know this, but what did your friends and your family and your wife see when they came to see you? I just want to make sure that people understand the extent of your injuries.
The way it was described to me is that the doctors initially took out two pieces of skull to let any brain swelling not make my brain explode in my head and kill me on the spot. But the swelling of my head has been compared to a beach ball, and if not just a beach ball, a very big beach ball. People tell me that they wouldn't have recognized me but for the freckles on my arms. I think they could see the tip of my nose and all of the swelling. I'm pretty mad that nobody took a picture of it, just my morbid curiosity that'll always kind of haunt me not to have been able to see that. But apparently I was in really bad shape, and very few people thought I was going to make it, but for my wife. My cousin, who's a trauma surgeon down in Virginia, I asked her for a number later on in the game, and she said about 10% chance survival is what her guess was. So they were planning eulogies, and I was, I guess, just a stubborn patient.
But your wife somehow believed that you would come back.
Yeah, I guess she respects my stubborn side, and I guess I just wasn't ready to go yet.
And in your case, it was crucial that you were found so quickly, and then also crucial that you were so close to a very good hospital.
Yep.
But what have you found, and Jim, you can weigh in on this as well, what have you found in terms of who typically finds or when are they found the victims of these accidents?
Whew. Man, Jim's probably better than this one. I don't know.
Because you have to be lucky to also be found.
Yeah, and Brian brought up a great point earlier. It's an equal opportunity type of crime. Happens on a busy street, happens on a dark road. I mean, I don't think there's any particular case that says this is the typical hit-and-run case. I think it's very difficult to kind of quantify what that would look like.
Do you see any trends in terms of times of year that seem to be where these accidents happen more often?
Yeah, typically pedestrian-involved accidents really spike in the autumn. You know, if you look at October, November, December, those are the most dangerous months to be a pedestrian. And as you would expect, unfortunately, Halloween, October 31st, and January 1st are the two most deadly days for pedestrians in the United States.
Now let's take a phone call. We have Julie joining us from Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Julie. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Thank you. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, talk about an incident that I was not involved in, but as a bystander, I was driving down the road. It was like 9:30 at night, and this man was trying to cross the road with a walker, and this big black SUV just boom right into him, and didn't even stop, didn't slow down, didn't nothing. There was like three of us. It was a busy street, like you guys were saying. It can happen on a busy street or a quiet street. And jumped out of the car, went over, dead. People never were found, never, you know, said anything, never even let it know. And it's really a shame, because when you have children, you know, one of the best memories I can remember is, you know, riding my bike around, you know, around the town with my friends and going down to the Quick Mart on the corner. And you just don't even want to let your kids ride their bike in their own neighborhood anymore for fear that, you know, they're going to get hit by somebody. I don't know if it has to do with the distraction, like you guys are talking about, the texting, the phone calling, you know, all these things that people are doing in their car nowadays. But something's got to give, because, you know, just 3 months after that, I saw another pedestrian that got hit. Thank goodness that person stopped. But, I mean, to see two pedestrians killed within a three-month period, one hit and run and one not, that seems a little out of the ordinary.
And, Julie, how much has witnessing this changed you as a pedestrian?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's changed me both as a pedestrian and mostly as a driver. I mean, you know, I'm down here in Southeast Florida where there's a very heavy population everywhere you turn. And whenever I'm in areas where there's people walking, I'm hyper alert, you know, to make sure that somebody doesn't accidentally slip off the curb or, you know, child run into the street or, you know, whatever. I've really cut back on my own personal texting and phone calling. It's just unnecessary. It's just, you know, what you're texting can wait the 20-minute drive till you get to where you are.
True, indeed. Julie, thank you so much for that call. Mm-hmm. Brian, you were smiling to yourself. What was going through your head as Julie was talking?
I've never seen anybody get hit by a car, so I'm just wondering what it looked like when I did, just selfishly trying to put myself in that situation. But the one thing, she identified herself as Fort Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm.
Tampa is one of the big areas. Like, I've seen, in keeping a list on my website of the various hit and runs, Tampa's a hot spot, Chicago's a hot spot. We're less so than them in Philadelphia, but we have a bunch too. So while there is no rhyme or reason to why they happen, I have found that some nooks of the country do have it more. I don't know what that says about the people in those areas, if anything, but they do tend to happen there with shocking regularity.
And I think Julie made an interesting point. I mean, 47% of all accidents involving pedestrians happen after 9 p.m. and before 3 a.m. So she'd mentioned the first accident was about 9:30 in the evening. That's when pedestrians are the most difficult to see. The other statistic that I'd just like to throw out there is that an unlicensed driver is about 66% more likely to be somebody that would have a hit-and-run accident. And again, you've reached the fear of being caught and penalized.
And what about, Julie also brought up another issue, and that's not just driver safety, which we can talk about later, but pedestrian safety. Do you have any advice on being as safe as you can be?
Yeah, and it's tough to I just want to be clear that we're not saying that a hit-and-run pedestrian is the person that caused the accident.
No, right, of course not.
But the most important thing for any pedestrian to do is just be aware, be alert. Where are you walking? What are you doing? And make sure, if you see a car, make sure that you're prepared to take action if they don't see you. Obey traffic signals. Walk on the sidewalks. If you're going to cross the road, try and find a crosswalk. Or if you're going to cross in the mid-traffic, just make sure you look left and right, then left again before crossing that street. Always watch for turning vehicles. Always just be as alert as possible. Don't, you know, jog with your headphones on. You can't hear the cars approaching behind you, that sort of thing.
I was going to ask you, Brian, in your article, which you reported on your own accident and your life afterwards, you talk about putting your headphones in. Do you still wear headphones when walking?
Yeah. The battery was dead in the iPod at that point. It actually died on the transit over there. But I'd put them in just out of habit. So the car was coming at me, so I don't think they played any role in it. But you're right. I mean, distracted. I mean, while you don't blame the hit-and-run walker, for lack of a better term, for the incident itself, I mean, there is a modicum of guilt there in that if you're distracted walking, maybe you're not where you're supposed to be and the car hits you. But you don't take off from the scene. It's that fleeing the scene is where my major problem is with it. Like,
sure,
I was on a street that was dark. The overhead lights weren't working. There was no sidewalk. So I was a step in from the side of the road where, by all intents, I could have been hit and probably knew I should or could have been hit. But it's the taking off. That's what's incomprehensible. It's not that I got hit. It's that someone left me there for dead.
We have another call at 1-888-477-9499. We have Georgia joining us from Ocean City. Hi, Georgia. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. My name is Georgina, and I just want to congratulate Brian for surviving. And it's so good to hear him. He was a great writer down here in South Jersey for the Press of Atlantic City.
Oh, thank you very much.
Philadelphia.
I recognize that accent anywhere.
Yes, and I just wanted, my question is, Brian, did you have health insurance, and how does that work if you don't?
I didn't, but I was covered through my wife's at the time, so thankfully I didn't have to find out how it worked without it. But in reporting the story, I did make a point to go get all the hospital bills to get an idea of what I would have been able to, or have been needed to come up with to cover my costs, and it came to about, I think, like $2.74 million or something like that. So thankfully, I didn't have to find a way to make $2.7 million because there's probably no legal way for me to do so.
Thank you for that call, Georgina, and for wishing Brian well. And Brian, the amount you just mentioned speaks to the incredible amount of treatment you received. So yeah. We said earlier you arrived at McGee, and there you had to relearn everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what did you do?
Well, they have a great staff at McGee. Upon arrival, half of my body was still paralyzed, so I couldn't do much for a couple days. So they were getting me in and out of bed with, I guess, a crane, or I forget what it's called, but like a crane.
A lift.
Yeah, a lift. So, I mean, they gradually, like it was, putting me on the side of a bed and moving my legs, and then building up to taking three steps, and then walking through the hallway, and then walking up and down the steps and learning how to get into a car. And then writing, I mean, that was part of the therapy as well, is since I could only use my left side, I had to learn how to write with my left hand, which I'm not very capable of doing. So it's just, it's baby steps, and literally, I guess, because it's almost as if you're starting with a new life where you're learning how to, I mean, even to go to the bathroom on your own, how to shower. And they know what they're doing, and they know the steps in which you can do that. And one of my therapists, Joe, he said they really never had a patient who was just so willing to listen to what they were doing. And I guess that's because I put aside my whiny nature about doing things I don't want to do and said, all right, what's going to get me out of here the fastest? And I really committed myself to that. It wasn't so much that I wanted to obey the therapists. It was get me to hell home.
But at the same time, you described that you were incredibly angry at the time. There was a rage that you felt. Was it at the driver? Was it at the situation?
I don't know. I don't know what exactly I knew what had happened to me. That was an instant. The anger was that I was laid up in a hospital with a netting around my bed, and I wasn't able to drink water when I wanted to, and I had to cover the hole in my throat to even try to say a word. I think it was more anger at the situation than what had put me there at that point. But I think now, what anger is left in me is directed at, since I don't know who did mine, when other people get caught for hitting and running, I'm more apt to kind of knock them around on my website just because I project my situation onto them.
Do you have an image of the person who hit you in your head?
Nah, there was a psychic who I talked to about a year later, who said it was a young girl with shiny hubcaps in a dark car. If I'm trying to figure it out, I think it was someone who was...
Sorry, you don't strike me like the guy who would go see a psychic.
No, he was a nice guy. He emailed me. He's like, hey, I want to talk to you about your case. I'm like, at that point, I'm like, all right, whatever. It wasn't like I'm going to a gypsy on the boardwalk or anything. It was a guy in Philly, and it was a temple. He's fine. I think it was a college kid that was home for the weekend, and I think they were coming back from Philly, and I think they were probably drunk, and I think mommy and daddy didn't want to see their little angel or saint go away, so they protected him or her.
But again, Jim Lardier with AAA, sure. We don't know anything about the ages. There is no profile.
And exactly. I mean, the person that hit Brian may be free, but may be carrying around an incredible amount of guilt over this. I mean, this is about as cold-blooded and inhumane as you can get towards another human being. And the fact that somebody thinks that they can just do that and life will be fine, you know, get that fender fixed, get the windshield fixed, whatever, and move on, I think speaks very poorly of that person. And I think we have to also look at the bigger picture, like Brian said. You know, are there family members that notice vehicle damage? Are there friends that know what happened? I mean, people have to step up, step forward, and give a face to the victim so that they know what happened. I mean, I don't hear Brian I think Brian's more concerned. You know, I hate to put words in your mouth, Brian, but I think it's not the fact that he was involved in an accident. It's the fact that somebody left him there.
Absolutely.
And turning a tragic accident into this cold-blooded crime, I think is something that we've got as a society. You know, we have to do what we can to put stronger laws on the books, make the laws that we have, you know, enforceable, and then expect society to step up when they notice that there's an accident and report it.
And Brian, communities have also really come out in support of victims and oftentimes against drivers. In your neighborhood as well, a few years ago there was a case where a restaurant owner in Philadelphia hit a girl and there was a lot of protesting, right?
Yeah, Kayla Peter. I forget the driver's name, but I had just moved to East Falls at the time, and it's my understanding, and from seeing stories about it, that they were out there every night just hammering away the fact that this woman was driving, and this woman, I think, was driving drunk, and she killed this poor girl and just took off out of self-preservation. And as a people, I don't know how we can tolerate that.
And Brian, you've been doing this website for several years now. Mm-hmm. You've talked about why you do it, but what are some other reasons why you do it? Why do you compile all of this information? Is it not compiled anywhere else?
There was a website, I believe it was called Deadly Roads, that was doing it before I came along, and I think he or she has stopped doing it just because of the massive time drain it is. I think I just did it out of habit and having time on my hands where I'm like, okay, these happen, they get covered on a first day basis, and nobody's keeping a list of them so people can see how dramatic it is that there's three or four happening a day sometimes. So I think it was a way where I could draw attention to other people, and to maybe, it sounds so cliche, but if just one person sees it listed on my website and calls the cops because they know, like if it's a one in Denver and just someone happens to be on my website and they call in because of it, that's worth all the time. But these can't be ignored, and to do so would make us no better than the drivers themselves.
And we only have a short moment left before we go to break, but does it, in your interactions with others and hearing these stories, does it help families when the driver is finally caught? Because sometimes that seems very hurtful too, because then the driver might go to jail for 30 days and then go on with their lives.
Yeah, but I think even 30 days shows that someone thinks that what happened mattered. You know?
Yeah, Jim, do you want to weigh in on this just a
no,
few seconds?
No, yeah, I totally agree with Brian's point. I mean, I think there needs to be a consequence, and the penalties may not be as strong as we like, but that is the penalty that's on the books. That's the law.
We're talking about hit-and-run accidents. We have Philadelphia journalist Brian Hickey in the studio, who was hit and hurt in an accident like that a few years back. And also joining us in the studio is Jim Lardier, who is Director for Public and Government Affairs for AAA Mid-Atlantic. We'll get to more of your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499 right after our break. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious or depressed, had mood swings, or been diagnosed with bipolar disorder? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is researching better treatment for bipolar disorder, anxiety, and depression. You may be eligible for a research study of the effects of medications or natural supplements to treat these symptoms. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for participation. To learn more, 215-662-3462, 215-662-3462.
The suicide rate has been increasing in the last decade here in the U.S. Suicide is among the 10 leading causes of death.
I felt like I was in this box, nobody around, I couldn't get out, and nobody could get in.
I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll explore this difficult and painful topic. We'll hear about the void left behind in families affected by suicide and discuss prevention. Today at noon, here on WHYY FM.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art Craft Show supports WHYY and presents its 35th annual show of one-of-a-kind and limited-edition contemporary American crafts. Jewelry, ceramics, glass, furniture, clothing, and more will be on view at the Pennsylvania Convention Center from November 10th through the 13th. 25 artists from Scotland will be featured. The Philadelphia Museum of Art Craft Show from November 10th through the 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. Tickets may be purchased at the door. For details, pmacraftshow.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about hit-and-run accidents today. Joining us in the studio is Brian Hickey. He is a WHYY's editor for the Germantown West Oak Lane hyperlocal section of our website, newsworks.org. And Brian is here today because in 2008 he was very, very hurt in a hit-and-run accident when he was a pedestrian. Also joining us is Jim Lardier, who's Director for Public and Government Affairs for AAA Mid-Atlantic. And we're getting lots of calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's go to Imran first. He is in New Jersey. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, how are you?
Hi, thank you. Well, I would like to, of course, congratulate Brian and Mr. Jim on their work. I think it's a very important topic. The hit and run, as lots of, lives have been lost or people have suffered in this tragedy. But I have a point that I observed as a physician when I'm now in New Jersey, but when I was working in Pakistan, and in some of the countries, I do know this for a fact, that I actually myself treated some victims of this problem, that when they came out of their car after they had accidentally hit somebody and they wanted to help that person, the people who had gathered around were so angry that they actually beat the people, the driver of the car, and sometimes they were even, badly hurt or rarely even killed in those, and this was quite a common problem. And people were scared to come out and help somebody that they had hit. And I only know that from a personal experience when I was 21 and driving my car, and a guy actually wrongly came in right in front of my car on a bike, and he hit my car and fell. And then so I stopped my car. Obviously, I applied the brakes, and he had come from a small road onto a big road. And he went on the windscreen, shattered the windscreen, fell off the green area. So I stopped after my car stopped, came out, worried, although whether somebody is going to, hurt me or not. I was only 21. I was a medical student then. I picked him up. He had some blood on, put him in my car, and took him to the hospital, which was 5 minutes away. Luckily, not many people were there, and, I would have stopped anyway, being that that's what I feel I should have done. And I actually paid for his expenses. He was a poor man. He was very grateful. But during the course of my career, I treated people who had really badly been beaten because they had come out to help the injured person that had been hurt by their car.
You bring up an interesting point. Let me just throw it over to Jim Lardier to see if we can get a perspective. Does that happen?
It certainly can, and I'm not aware of any recent things in the United States, but that's certainly a fear. I think there was a story out of New York City might even be 10 years ago where something similar happened. But you're right. This is a society problem. This is community's problem. I think if somebody stops to render aid and they are then attacked, I think that unfortunately says a lot about the community. I mean, accidents happen, and treating that type of situation. If you're afraid to render aid, I might be the best person in the world, but, I'm not going to step out of that car. So I think as a society, as a global society, or whether, we're talking here in the United States, people have to accept the moral responsibility to be that, person that's going to stop, get out, and do what they can to help turn that tragedy, that accident, and not make it any worse.
Brian?
I've seen a couple instances of that in a 2,000-some list that I've kept. And, yeah, Jim's right. I mean, it's you can't attack someone who stops and helps. But then again, if you're in fear for your life in doing so, just drive away a couple blocks, dial 911, give your name, and you'll have lived up to your moral necessity, I guess.
You can still do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's take another call. We have Doug joining us from East Falls. Hi, Doug. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Go ahead.
So, in 2006, I was involved in a hit and run. I was riding my bicycle in West Philadelphia in a bike lane. And aside from the fact that I don't know exactly how it happened, I awoke from a coma and then a period where I couldn't remember anything after about a month. And I spent about a year recovering, and I'm very, very, very lucky to have recovered as well as I have.
And Doug, did you ever find any information on what happened to you? Who found you?
I have no idea who found me. I was told that there was surveillance of a large quad cab pickup truck that was white that had hit me, but it was hauling an ATV in the bed, and so no one was able to find out what the license plate was, who it was, and I heard nothing about it.
And how are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm working now to help other people who have had traumatic brain injuries as well.
And how has the traumatic brain injury changed you? If not physically, are there other ways in which it has changed you?
Absolutely. I mean, mentally it does numbers, and Brian can attest to this, I'm sure. Basically, my memory is pretty poor, my short-term memory especially. But I suffer from a lot of fatigue. As a teacher, I'll get down the end of the day and I'll just be ready to pass out immediately. And if you try to have a conversation with me at the end of a long day, you're out of luck. But physically, no problems really, because, well, I was just so lucky. I had a broken arm, but and a shattered helmet and a shattered bicycle, but still.
Yeah, and do you still ride your bike?
I do. As a matter of fact, having recovered, I went through my rehabilitation, and doctors were saying to me, we don't think he's going to walk, let alone ride a bike. But I said, if I can ever ride a bike, I'm going to ride as far as I can. So this past summer, I rode 3,256 miles from San Francisco to New Jersey to kind of raise awareness.
Oh, right. Okay. I know who you are now. Thank you so much for calling in, Doug. That's a great story. And Brian, what's your comment?
Doug makes me look lazy. All I'm doing is keeping a list online, and he's pedaling across country, up and down mountains. I recognized Doug when he started talking, and he's fighting the good fight, too. And to spread the word as far as he can, he's to be commended. And I don't think I could ride 32 miles, let alone 3,200.
And Brian, how has the accident changed you, if at all, in terms of your brain function?
I think it's relatively the same as it was before. I was always a heavy note taker in the course of my job, and I still am. Maybe I'm a little more forgetful than I was before, but that could also just be being 38 years old and having your first child, and you're frantic and frazzled. So I don't know whether it has had any lasting impact on my mental ability.
But Jim, there's a lot of long-lasting costs to these accidents that we may not think about. Somebody who maybe has impaired function, who recovers to some extent, but will need care for many years to come.
Sure. The costs of being in a car accident are huge. I'd like to just say congratulations to Doug. That's an incredible bike ride. For anybody to do that. So great job, Doug, and for keeping people aware of TBI. You're right. In concussions, you even see that in sports. I mean, playing football, kids playing, high school sports, the damage to a brain is not fully understood unless you've had like a baseline before. What was Brian capable of? What did he do before? And now here's the accident. What is he doing? And be able to measure that. I think it's immeasurable in the most part.
I do have a much more difficult time watching football now, though, to piggyback that, because I don't see headshots the same as I did before. I got one of my own, and I have to turn away a lot, and I watch a lot less of it, and I think less of the sport itself, just because of it's so easy to avoid the kind of helmet-to-helmet contacts that bring on TBI, but there's an unwillingness to even accept that as anything but making the sport less tough, and it's not that at all. It's being responsible as a human being not to drive your helmet into someone else's head.
We have another call from Chris in Cherry Hill. Hi, Chris. You're on Radio Times.
Good afternoon to everybody.
Hi.
First and foremost, I really want to tell you how sorry I am to hear that your guest had to live through what he had to live through. Me raising two children, I'm very cognizant of the dangers out there, and I do my best to take care of them. However, number two, I'm not in agreement with the gentleman from AAA with regard to there should be stronger laws, higher penalties, more jail time. And the reason for that is because what you're telling the public is, if you happen to be in an accident and this happens to go down, if you're already in self-preservation mode under the current laws and conditions, I think if you take his tact, people will sit back and think, well, no, wait, if I stop and render a help, I'm going to be in more severe trouble than I am if I drive away. So my contention is pretty simple. Let's put it out there to the public that, look, things happen. Even if you're drunk, even if you're DWI, even if you're driving with a suspended license, the courts will still look at you with tremendous leniency if you will stop, render assistance, and do the best you can to make a bad situation good.
And Chris, I think
that's... I don't believe that people should be put on notice that it's going to be the reverse.
I think that's part of what, Jim, you were saying, actually, that right now you get less of a punishment, you know, for doing that than for drunk driving. So go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're taking me a little bit out of context. I think that there needs to be enforcement of the laws that are on the books. If you look at a study that was done out of California, 21% of all fatal accidents between 1993 and 1999 involved an unlicensed driver. And if you look at the statistic I gave earlier that says an unlicensed driver is 66% more likely to be involved in a hit and run, I think there's some things that we could do to certainly bring those numbers down. And as far as enforcement, I think if you look at the laws that are on the books, they vary between state to state. Some laws may need to be strengthened to bring them in line with neighboring states. But I think the point is, this is an issue about morals and about ethics. And the people involved in a hit and run, I think, are a danger to themselves and to other drivers down the road. If this is what they're capable of, we need to be getting these people off the road.
And Brian?
The crime of what happened to me isn't that I got hit by a car. It's that they took off. And I'd like to think that even if they were hammered when they hit me, but they had stopped at the scene, once I was able to shake a hand, I would have been able to say, hey, you know what? You stopped. Like, that's good enough for me.
So the anger would have been taken out of that?
Yeah. Well, maybe not. Who knows?
All right.
I'd like to think so.
Let's see if we can get a very quick call in from Marie. She's in Arkansas. Hi, Marie. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a native Philadelphian whose father was killed in 1997 by a hit-and-run driver.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And it was only blocks from my house. He was out on his daily walk. And when you talk about how does it impact people, I mean, that was 13 years ago. I would say it took a long time for me to feel that I didn't think about him every day. But I have to tell your guest that my father would not have gone through what he had gone through. He would want us to be dead. He would not have been as strong as you. He would not have been as brave as you, because he always told us, you know, if you have to put him in a hospital, he's just not going to survive. So for us, because it was instant, that was the smallest of blessings. But it's been hard on everybody. It's impacted the priest who was walking across the street when it happened. You know, it impacted, he was right at the hospital, and they still couldn't save him. There were doctors and nurses right there when it happened. It was a young man stole a car.
Yeah.
And he was using drugs. And as a matter of fact, I got the call to come to the hospital. I passed the intersection where he was killed, and I didn't know that where it happened. I saw the car on the side of the road that was abandoned. And I go in and identify my father's body. And I have to be the one to call my family, his sister, his mother, to say, your 58-year-old son and brother was killed. You know? So it does impact people. It does. It
Marie,
does change you for the rest of your life.
Marie, I'm I'm sorry, but we're coming up on the end of our show, and I want to thank you so much for calling us and for sharing that story, because I think, Brian, that's the story. There's a huge ripple effect when something like this happens. It's not just you who got hit. It was your wife. It was your family, your friends. Everybody suffered. In Marie's case, it was her father who died. But the whole family, the whole community has changed forever.
Yeah, I think it was a lot harder on my wife and family than it was on me, because I was in la-la land for 10 days and then kind of not there for another 2 weeks. So it's, I didn't see the worst of it, and I didn't feel the worst of it, but they did, and there's nothing that I can do to take that away except thank them for everything they did.
And in summary, we have about a minute and a half left. Jim, what do you think is the most important work that can be done to make the roads safer and to stop people from doing this, from hitting and running?
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, pedestrians, I'll just go back to my point. Just make sure you're aware of the situations, you know, you're putting yourself in, and the other piece is, you know, let's figure out. I mentioned unlicensed drivers. I mentioned uninsured drivers. I mentioned people that are afraid of being caught, putting self-preservation. I think there needs to be, you know, thankfully, the number of traffic fatalities continues to decrease. I mean, these numbers decrease, but still a single one is far too many as far as AAA is concerned. So
pulling people over while they're driving unlicensed and not...
Yeah, I mean, you know, find out why, you know, what you can do as a state, as a police agencies, as whoever, pull the unlicensed drivers off the road, the uninsured drivers off the road, the DUI checkpoints. I mean, all of that stuff goes a long way to being visible signs of deterrence.
And Brian, any closing thoughts?
Well, if the person who hit me is listening, just they should know that I'm still looking for them.
And where can people find your website?
BrianPHickey.com.
BrianPHickey.com. That's Brian Hickey. He is now with WHYY as the editor for the Germantown West Oak Lane hyperlocal section of our website, newsworks.org. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Jim Lardier is director for public and government affairs for AAA Mid-Atlantic. Thank you so much, Jim, for your work
and
for joining us. You've been listening to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain.